Happy April 5th, everyone. Monday.
Good morning. Monday, April 5th.
There's our little friend, Bubo.
Hi, everybody.
So people need to understand something. Bubo is not our mascot. Bubo is our leader.
Yes, definitely.
When we aren't on this show, Bubo tells us things that we should tell you.
Yes. And, you know, and everybody may have noticed that the robot birds are out in force. You know, people think that this is about migration. Silly people.
It's because it's warm out, so people are outside, so the birds can survey us more, so they show up to survey.
Exactly. Exactly. They've got more people to keep track of because everybody's out and about, so they've got to deploy them.
That's right. Before we go too far down this road, we should introduce ourselves. I'm Mark Van Steenwyck. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing. Good morning to folks who are saying good morning to us. And so we got a three-part series. What is that little asterisk there?
Okay, here's the thing. Everyone knows I'm not averse to cussing, but here's the thing, and this is a good thing to remind. We've had a strike against us because we've done episodes about QAnon, and somehow the algorithms think maybe we're promoting it or not. We had a warning, then a strike, and so I think we can't stream to YouTube for like another few days at least. But then I also got a notification that like streaming is kind of, if we have 1,000 subscribers, then like we can stream from any platform. So we're trying to get people, if you're watching this and you even vaguely like what we're saying, please go to YouTube, search for Center for Prophetic Imagination and follow and subscribe. Because if we get 1,000 subscribers, which isn't a whole lot, it'll be harder to not.
We win.
We win. We win the internet. Somehow.
Yeah. Algorithms. Yeah. So this series is in part inspired by Julia Allen. So if you don't like it, it's her fault. And
blame. It's not our fault. And it's not even, especially not Bubo's fault.
Yeah. So, but she wrote us a great note. And this is a similar thing that we've gotten from folks from time to time. A lot of what we talk about is are things that are problematic. And sometimes I think people get irritated or sick of that. And they're like, tell us how things could be better. And so a lot of that to me falls under the issue of the spiritual life in general. And that really is central to the work that both Mark and I do, the lives that we try to live. And we've talked about that a lot on this on transmission over the last year, but you know, you really can never talk about it too much. So we thought we would kind of dive back into that. And how is it that the spiritual life informs how we live in the world in the midst of the challenges and problems? And yeah, what does a realistic kind of hope or way of orienting our lives mean?
Just want to say one little thing that's, I mean, maybe straddles the line between mysticism and politics, which is where I live, I guess. But oftentimes people will say things, and I think this ties directly into how the spiritual life can be a posture politically. Oftentimes people assume like, oh, you're complaining. You have no right to complain unless you have a systemic analysis and a blueprint of how the world should be and a 7-step guide to get there. So it's very blueprinted. Now, my assumption is, okay, sorry for all the Marxist-Leninists, which the anarchists call tankies, by the way, out there. I think once you start with a blueprint and try to enforce it upon the world, it brings great suffering and violence. Anarchists...
It's a recipe for doom.
Yeah, anarchists, and not just anarchists, but this is the tradition I'm most informed by, tend to assume, no, it's really about a posture and a set of practices, because you don't know the blueprint, and you shouldn't. And so you need to create egalitarian and democratic or direct ways of processing towards righteousness, and that'll kind of like create the blueprint. Now, this is important spiritually, because that's what discernment is. It's assuming you do not know the mind of God. You don't know what the Spirit's end goal is, and the Holy Spirit doesn't just give us a blueprint. The Bible, by the way, is also not a blueprint. And so if you read it that way, you're doing the same thing the Marxist-Leninists did, trying to force your will upon the world. But if you take this posture of how do we discern without knowing where it's going, to me, that's partly for me why I'm so drawn to the spiritual life. Now, that doesn't mean you just give up the caring about, like, and having an idea about what a just society could be like. It just doesn't put the emphasis as much there. And this is important, because if you have that posture, which I do, people will say, well, you're arrogant, or you're arrogant and you're depressed, and you're just saying negative things, and you're just calling everyone out, but you don't have a better idea. And I'm like, well, no, I don't have a better idea. That's the point. I'm not trying to have a better idea of how the world could be exactly. I'm trying to figure out how we start tearing down walls of division between us, other creatures, the land, and God, and then start moving towards healthy relationships. And this is a discerned thing. So,
yeah. And so, some other language around what you're talking about is mm-hmm. that it really has a lot to do with process versus content. I mean, one yes. of the problems that I run into all the time, you know, treats and teaching and talking to folks about that, is that everybody immediately wants to jump to what do I do?
Yeah.
Right. So, and it's like, okay, so I've got one Saturday a week, a month that I can volunteer, and tell me what I do to fix the world, right? Or, you know, how do I reorient my shopping habits? Tell me what to do to fix the world. And, you know, that one is a very natural thing in our society. I mean, for sure. American society forms us into that. You know, what do we go do? And then also whiteness very much forms people into how do I go fix things?
Oh, my God. I mean, the core of mansplaining is this tendency to think you know how to fix things.
Right, exactly.
It's like all the memes about the barge that got stuck in the Suez Canal. That I'm like, this is what you need to do. I'm like, oh, my God, you didn't even. This is indicative.
Right. Yeah. And so the spiritual life does not start with that at all. The spiritual life starts with how am I formed, right? Who am I, right? Who am I? And, yeah. you know, one of my favorite spiritual phrases from this comes from the Buddhist tradition is give up all hope of fruition, right? Which, you know, on the face of it could sound very depressing, right?
you think
give up all hope. Give up all hope that you're ever going to succeed, right? But this is this starting posture which allows us to lean into the challenges of the world, right? And so in addition to this phenomenon of we want to do everything and have the answers and have that blueprint, part of what that's covering over, right, is that we don't want to look at the vast problems of the world, because that can feel overwhelming. Right? And but one of the important starting points, we have to really look at what's going on.
Another piece to this, which is important in view of whiteness, is part of spiritual life, besides giving up all hope of fruition, is this sort of persistent humility and curiosity. So if you're with any spiritual teacher that that I think is helpful, they'll point out humility and how you need to start looking at your own self, even your most harsh behaviors, with a sense of curiosity. But then also the world. Like, so part of it is white people were conditioned, especially white men, are conditioned to think we have more access to knowing what to do than almost anybody else. And this place of humility reminds us, especially if you bring in sort of a liberation theology lens, that if there are solutions, they're not likely to come from you as a white man. They're going to come from somewhere else, and you're not going to see them unless you're damn curious and humble about it. So even if you're solutions oriented, which some of us are wired that way, so maybe you're just kind of like, you know, grew up tinkering with things and you're an engineer by nature. Okay, good. Solutions minded people, you need to be doing work in the world. Creativity is important. Forging a path, great. But have the humility to know that maybe you're not the one to figure it out. And the curiosity to say, well, I wonder who has some insights that might be worth looking at. And this all ties into the spiritual life.
Yeah. So one of my other favorite phrases, which relates to this, is that revulsion is the foot of meditation. Revulsion is the foot of meditation. And so that what this talks about is the fact that until we are revolted by things as they are, we never really start to engage the spiritual life. Because if we're not revolted by things, then we simply are going, the natural human tendency is to default to whatever our habitual formation is. And if our habitual formation is working for us, right? And this is why, for people who are succeeding in society, they look around and they go, hey, everything's fine, right? Because, their nice little manicured suburb is fine, and their nice little job is fine, and, their nice little life is fine. And they're just like, oh, yeah, I know there's some problems out there, but everything's basically fine. And just, if everybody was like me, then the world would be fine. Right. And so this teaching to move towards revulsion is it's not what we're conditioned to do.
No, right? We're conditioned to be self-deceived about our role in the world. And also to, if we feel revulsion, to bracket it off and approach it with judgment. And so this is where the predominant metaphor within Christianity, as I've seen it, is if you notice something that we would call sin, or to put it in the vernacular, something that's fucked up, that's what sin is, just means it's fucked up, really. Let's just take the spiritual language out of it for a second. Anything fucked up, you can call it sin, fine. That you just don't bracket off and say, those people. But instead, having a kind of a dynamic systems way of looking at things is like, well, that's fucked up. How do I relate with the fucked upness? We live in a world of vast fuckery, of which I am a part. How do I change the way I relate amidst this fuckery, rather than how do I get good at naming what's bad and bracket it off and try to kill it? Now, I'm all for like some of the guillotine language about eating the rich. But that's not enough. Because if we somehow guillotined all the rich, in a generation there'd be new rich. We have to figure out how to change our fundamental way of relating with one another in the world.
We got a few comments we throw up.
I'm enjoying the language vast fuckery. We talked about the title, and I just realized, I suggested fuckery, but I felt with the title fuckery was not enough of a term by itself. So I had to add the word vast because to show the complexity of the fuckery. And so, the fuckery is vast. This would be a great title for a memoir to say. I'm just thinking about that, how to use vast fuckery in a title for something. Love the title. A lot of fuckery going on, no doubt about it. We'll have to watch the live stream later. Lisa, I'm assuming this is tongue in cheek. The Bible, not a blueprint. How dare you? I'm apoplectic and it's only Monday.
Yes.
And Ellen raises a good point. I don't want to oversell the idea of blueprints being bad. I just think they're overplayed. Ellen says, why I think socialist blueprint is good is there are mechanisms for systemic accountability when we are coordinated. Yeah, so I think processes, systems, all that stuff is important. But, you know, if you have just some sort of pure utopian idea that's disembodied from current reality and say, we need to do whatever necessary to get there, I mean, it can be it's problematic, but I don't want to oversell that point. Kathleen writes, when we meet new people, we often want to know what they do for a living. We equate our jobs with living, even though we're really only talking about what do you do to acquire stuff.
Yeah, and so, you know, this this gets at one of the really important points in this is, right, what does living even mean? Right? I mean, how do we engage in the world in a life that is meaningful? And you know, this again is really a question of the spiritual life. This is that what the spiritual life looks at is what are the sum total of our relationships, and what is our orientation to ourselves, to others, and to the universe. And if that's not the starting point, then all of this other activity tends to just be tinkering. Right? And again, this is very hard for us because we do immediately want to jump to, well, what do I do? Or when people hear this, they're like, well, what I'm hearing is, you know, everything I'm doing is bad and I need to feel hopeless. Right? And that is not what's being talked about, but it's a subtle shift, but it's a very powerful kind of shift. You know, and so, I mean, one great example, which is going on right now here in Minneapolis and that people are seeing around the world, right, is this Derek Chauvin trial. And if you look at this, it really is this obscene kind of, you know, Greek theater. I mean, it is absolutely obvious to anybody with half a brain that what this guy did was murder and horrible and obscene. And you know, really the conversation should be about 5 minutes long. Like, yeah, you did this, you're guilty, you go to jail. And yet what's happening is that we're spending millions and millions of dollars, taxpayer dollars, not only for the trial, but for, you know, turning Minneapolis into the Baghdad green zone.
And the civil settlement.
Yeah, the civil settlement, you know, $27 million that we're all paying. You know, millions of hours of media coverage, people talking about it, all this kind of stuff. And yet, for what? Right? And for the possibility that this guy might get off. Right? So to look at that in a clear-eyed way, and to experience and feel the pain and the sorrow and the obscenity of that, that is that starting point of revulsion. And this is the reason why we need to sit with that revulsion, because revulsion ultimately becomes motivating. And that's why it's the foot of meditation, because when we really allow ourselves to be revolted and disgusted by the world as it is, we get motivated. And we say, okay, I want this to be different. I want to devote my life to this being different. And that becomes extremely powerful. But we don't get there if we are continually wanting to turn away from the revulsion.
Gus says, Kathleen, I love the reframing of, instead of asking what you do for a living, like what makes you come alive? I think that's generally good. It's awkward to do that because of how dominant it is to say, well, what do you do? And if you answer with something like, well, sometimes I watch Netflix, people listen, don't. If you ask what makes you come alive, I could see that putting people off, but it's a great way of reframing it, things like that. Thanks for asking this clarifying question, Don. Are you okay with killing the rich? I'm being a little flippant. No, I'm not. I'm not okay with killing the rich. I'm okay with killing affluence. I mean, I take.
Right. I'm okay with defunding the rich.
I'm okay with destituting the rich and making them live off Section 8. I'm okay with all that. Like, I take Paul very seriously on this idea that we don't fight against flesh and blood, really. We fight against the principalities and powers. And to me, capitalism is what really we're fighting against. And yes, that means we have to neutralize the power of the rich. But my thing on this with violence, I'm pacifistic, but I recognize that the violence of the powerful is such that if they're not heeding the call to repentance, eventually it'll spill over to them dying in a revolution. And that's sad, but it's not the revolters' fault at that point. That's kind of how I bring this all together. Although we could talk about we've talked about pacifism on this show before. It's really dicey. So no, I'm not okay with killing the rich. Ellen writes, I love anarchism for what does really living the good life even mean? I also love socialism because sometimes you need a material approach because of a material need. Spend like days talking about this. To me, anarchism, any anarchism that isn't just anti-authoritarian socialism isn't anarchism. So to me, those aren't two different things. I guess where I was going with the blueprint thing is this. Okay, so Marx assumed that history, because of dialectical materialism, which is a big philosophical thing, would kind of have to go through stages to get to the goal. And in order to get there, he's like, well, we need to industrialize this shit. And so there was all sorts of violence that happened in order to take an agrarian peasant society up to the next notch so it could move its way down this course of history. And to me, that's where blueprinting becomes violent. Instead of saying, well, because if you look at the Chiapas, where the Zapatistas are, it's an agrarian peasant society, and they revolted and found ways of creating systems that didn't require them working with this rigid blueprint of the pure science of history, the way Marx talked about and that Lenin tried to implement. That's very nerdy. So Stefan writes, revulsion, yes. Again, me with my dualism. I like the framing, for example, by Greg Boyd, of having a warfare worldview instead of a blueprint worldview. I don't know what BW stands for. Maybe I'm missing that. Everything says everything is ultimately a part of God's plan and goes according to God's sovereign blueprint versus it's about the fight against the powers and principalities. We live in an unjust world, which we must participate in fixing. Yeah, I think that can be helpful.
And one of the things that this gets to as well, and I think this has something to do with the push towards material activity and what do I do, right, is that we're not in tune with the fact that there is also a non-material reality, a spiritual reality, where these things are playing out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a number of us, and we've talked about it on the show, and other people have talked about this, have discussed how in this last year, and particularly with the election and with all that's going on, you know, with the uprisings, fight for justice, that there is a spiritual dimension to this struggle. Mm-hmm. Right? And those of us that have been involved with the spiritual life for a long time, I mean, we can feel this. You can feel this, and you can feel yourself participating in this. And so that you may be, quote, doing nothing except your spiritual life, but you are actually doing something in terms of engaging the struggle. And the thing is, if we're not in tune with that, then yeah, we can feel a great deal of sort of frustration or despair of like, well, I'm not doing enough. I'm not, but you know, the truth is that if we are being formed into loving beings who are relating to ourselves in a loving way, who are relating to others to the wider reality in a loving way, You know what? We're so far ahead of the game, right? Like there are just lots and lots of people that are not even doing that, right? And that begins to add to the spiritual weight of love and caring in the universe, which begins to move things, right? And so we are participating in this vast movement towards good, this desire that is there in the universe towards good and caring. And that's one of the most important things that we can do. Right? but again, if we feel like through our social formation, that the material world is the only game in town. And then I've got to be anxious, like, am I doing enough by my activities? Right? We're just missing a giant chunk of the picture. And again, the spiritual life fills in that entire frame that oftentimes we're not connected with.
You know, and this kind of this doing enough question, I feel like we've talked before about it. We've talked a little bit about it kind of tangentially a little bit about what discernment is. It seems like probably as we continue this week, we'll have to really get to the brass tacks of a discernment posture and what that looks like. But I say that because I think we have an overinflated sense of the power of our choices. Like I got into a little bit of an argument the other day with this, where people will often come to me and get upset at what I'm saying, and because they're assuming that society is the sum total of individual human choices, and that therefore the only thing you can do is choose differently. And what they mean by that is like, look, if you recycle, it scales up. And I'm like, there's several breaks in logic that happen there, but you can't see it because you overinflate the power of choice. Discernment sees the power of choice, but recognizes that any old choice won't do. Like, the spirit is at work in the world, and we have to discern and participate, because just throwing choices against the wall and actions against the wall, most of them don't stick. And we don't even know the choices that we could make that are powerful most of the time. They go past us. That's why we spend billions of dollars about voting for the president, and then we ignore the vast multitude of other choices that we could do to make the society a better place, because we just don't have a way to discern the power of our choices. Alan writes, if revulsion is the foot of meditation, what does this say about the high correlation where even American evangelical conservatives having a high propensity to disgust? That's a good question.
That kind of disgust, which is really related to, the purity problems that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that these are not the same thing. That sort of disgust, again, as we talked about, has a lot to do with legalism. It has a lot to do with, you know, what are these right or wrong actions that are going to send me to hell? You know, they have a lot to do with this kind of judgment piece, like if I do the wrong thing, God's going to get me. this contemplative revulsion is very different. This contemplative revulsion, again, is the sense that arises out of seeing things for the way they are and recognizing that they are not enlightened, right? That they are not loving. It's not this idea of, again, I have the right answer, the list of the good and bad things, and now I see that people are doing the bad things, and so, ooh, that's gross, or, you know, God's going to get you if you're not doing the right thing. Right. This has much more to do with looking at the totality and really saying, like, you know, is this loving? Right. So, you know, I see a tent city in my city, and I see empty houses, and that should be revolting. Right. Why should people be living in this kind of way when we have other ways for people to live? And so, and this is always a challenge with all this stuff, right, is that we have a particular word, we have a particular concept, and we really need to spend time digging into that. What does it mean? Because, of course, these terms mean lots of different things depending on your setting and context.
Yeah, and to me, this idea of revulsion, the way you're using it, Dan, to me ties more into the idea of lament than the ooh, gross sense. And I mean, the tent city is a great example, because I know people who walk past and go like, ew, gross, these dirty homeless people. Versus if I walk past it and I saw the cops monitoring, I'm like, oh, gross, fucking cops. Two very different postures, but you know, the word gross might be there. When you're talking about revulsion in Buddhism, it reminds me of the charnel meditation practice of like meditating mm-hmm. over a corpse. And to me, it shows that orientation, like, don't be disgusted by things that are part of life. Like, don't be disgusted because two men are making out on the bench. That's not, you can notice that and be curious about what's coming up for you. But the thing you should be disgusted by is the system of, you know, being trapped in the karmic cycle, being stuck in a capitalist system, these things that cause us to do harm to one another. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not moralistic disgust. It's not moralistic disgust. Yeah, it's lament at the lack of love. Really. That's really what it
is. James writes, I think most of the seasons in the church calendar hint at revulsion with the way things are or challenging the powers. I agree. I mean, I wish more people kind of engaged it that way. Same with scripture. It's just baked this all throughout scripture, but it's amazing how much it turns into a moralistic text.
Yeah, I mean, look, the entire prophetic tradition is about this sort of revulsion, right? I mean, the prophets see the rich crushing the poor, and they're revolted by that, and they cry out. Even some of the prophetic language is about God being revolted, right? I despise your festivals, right? I hate your religious hypocrisy. I'm disgusted by all of this because there isn't justice. So it's that kind of prophetic revulsion.
Gus writes, blueprint seems like the wrong metaphor for going forward. It's a lot more like exploring or mapping a new topography. We can only know where we can go by moving forward once to the top of the next rise, new paths become open and clear to us. And that's great. Like, that's, to me, moves more in the direction of like, okay, there's some planning, there's systemic analysis, there's deep understanding and learning involved, but we don't know. So we have to take this discernment approach rather than, look, I came up with this plan, I'm going to make it happen.
Yeah, it's an emergent property, right? Reality is emerging, and the reality that emerges depends a lot on the kind of posture, activity, formation of the people that are engaged, right? And so, so it's not something that is imposed from without. It's something that arises from within.
Lisa says, lament, discomfort, or move to change. Yeah, and this is, to me, this is, I like this, you know, we translate things poorly, but a lot of times knowing when the way it's used in the scriptures is like a gut knowing. And so when Jesus is moved, it's not in, from the heart, it's like from the gut. And so to me, this is like this idea of disgust, that sort of visceral reaction, like, oh my God. This dude kneeled on someone's neck. Like, what? That's so fucked up. What do we do about it? That's kind of this sort of disgust. And disgust should move us to want to engage things. And like when we couch spirituality as cutting off from that deep visceral reaction, which happens a lot in spiritual spaces and spiritual movements, it creates this sort of inauthentic way of being human that can't recognize the disgust. Like even the sort of like why I'm okay with this idea of people talking about eating the rich and guillotines is because I recognize that their disgust is warranted. And so I don't want to stifle that feeling. But I, of course, I don't want the streets bathed in the blood of the wealthy. That's not something I actually want.
All right. So final word.
I'm going to do this and then Catherine will have the last word. Indignation is a good term. That might be a good indignation. Catherine writes, I feel like a lot of my adult spiritual life has involved reclaiming disgust and lament from the places Imperial Christianity pointed me. For example, towards my own sin and failures as a queer, neurodivergent person, towards more moral failings like sleeping late and playing Dungeons and Dragons. Man, that Dungeons and Dragons is such a moral failure. Anyways, I could go nerd out on Dungeons and Dragons. And but instead into lament for the violence hidden in plain sight in just about every system of our society.
There we go.
Totally, totally getting it nail on the head right there. But in, to me, it's because part of the disgust is not only how violent and gross it is, but the fact, and this is the hardest part for me about my spiritual life, is looking around and seeing that most people don't seem to notice it. And it intensifies the feeling of disgust, intensifies the anxiety and the need to want to do something, and then increases and therefore the likelihood that I'm going to do something in a very white male way that actually makes the problem worse. Hence the need for the spiritual life.
All right. Well, thank you. It's great. Oh,
Bowels of Compassion, English translation of Jesus's Motivation. Thank you.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks for starting out this week with us. Mm-hmm. Appreciate y'all, everybody. And we'll continue this on Wednesday.
See you in a couple days, everybody. Bye. Thank you.